The first argued case this morning is number 21-1745, Advanced Voice Recognition against Apple Incorporated. Mr. Buther.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Eric Buther on behalf of the appellant AVRS. There are two issues before this Court. One is the dispositive nature of lexicography when it comes to claim construction. And the second is what I would call PTAB procedure in the SAS era. In particular, how should the PTAB handle itself if it decides to do an about face and change its view on the grounds for unpatentability? And how should it treat the parties when it decides to change its view on that? So those are the two issues. If I could address the lexicography issue first, the error that the PTAB committed here was that it disregarded the rule of construction giving lexicography pretty much dispositive effect and as controlling. And that was error because claim construction is essentially a search for the intent of the patentee.
Counsel, in this situation, I understand you're arguing lexicography, but what do we do with the scenario? Let's assume for a minute that the first time the patent, I think it's in column 3, lines 44 through 48, it has a parenthetical where it defines speech. And it says, which includes, which is an open-ended phrase, spoken text and spoken and embedded commands. So let's assume you're right. That is a definition. But what about the fact that later in the patent, it says several times that the speech, typically it says it includes spoken text, and typically includes formatted speech and embedded commands, or may include formatted speech and embedded commands. Doesn't that either influence the definition that's provided in the parenthetical you're relying on, or alternatively, it certainly changes it. It makes it so your definition is no longer one that should be attributed as the exclusive definition provided by the inventors in the application.
Certainly, Your Honor, that those permissive words should be considered by the PTAB or any court in evaluating what was the true intent of the patentee when he used or she used those terms in a claim. But here, those permissive examples that the PTAB did rely on were not irreconcilably inconsistent with the clear definition. The definition that was provided was clearly a definition. It wasn't.
Is your view that it's a requirement, right? That the speech include not only spoken text, but also spoken
both.
And embedded.
Yes, commands. That's a clear edict of the definition, and the PTAB never said it was ambiguous or less than clear. It just found these instances of permissive language as something that it should consider, but in the court's view of things, the lexicography controls and is almost always dispositive unless there's other passages in the specification that undermine the clarity.
Why isn't this one of those scenarios?
Well,
that statement, I mean, assuming your interpretation of the parenthetical is correct, which I'm not sure it is, but assuming it is, why won't those later statements undermine the lexicography you're relying on?
Well, as I say, I don't think they undermine because lexicography is the best and clearest example of what is the inventor's intent. And when you couple that with the fact that there's no finding of ambiguity, that this was in the system nomenclature section of the specification where all the other definitions, which everyone agreed was a definition and binding, existed. And so to kind of yank this one out and treat it separately and not give it the same respect as the other definitions where the lexicography controls was inappropriate. In addition, there were seven other instances where the lexicography definition was repeated as controlling. And so
why should I, just going to this, I'm going to go to the details on this now, which is why should the word includes be interpreted to mean require?
Well, it shouldn't. And if there weren't a section of lexicography in the specification, and if it didn't say this is the definition of speech, I would say it would be an interesting argument, and probably the better of the argument would be that it's permissive and not mandatory. But when you have a clear mandatory definition,
but in that definition says which includes spoken text.
That's not a definition, Your Honor. That was simply an example or an embodiment of the mentioned in the patent. And this court in Braintree made it clear that even with a embodiment or preferred embodiment, when there's a clear lexicography, that trumps the embodiment language that is at least not irreconcilably inconsistent with the definition. This is not irreconcilably inconsistent at all. It is simply permissive.
I want to ask you another question, which
sure.
is I'm really having a hard time understanding why this claim construction, why you're not seeking an advisory opinion on this claim construction. Exactly what issue does this go to, and that's actually properly before us?
The harmful error issue, yes. Well, as we pointed out, as AVRS pointed out in his preliminary response, Apple did not allege or submit any evidence showing that any of the prior art that it was relying upon satisfied the lexicography definition of speech. It never made any allegation that any of the prior art, when the word speech was used in the claims, met the lexicography definition. It only met the alternative, one or the other. It didn't meet both. And so therefore...
Go ahead, please. I was going to say, isn't the language, though, in the claims speech information request? Is that the part that
That's true. Speech is only one part of the phrase, but speech is a claim term that was defined in the specification as requiring both spoken text and embedded text.
If you just turn with me to like claim 15, for example.
Yes.
Right? And when you look at that, it talks about speech information request and it uses the word respectively. And it mentions formatted spoken text is what I'm seeing here. And then it has responses, which the way I'm reading that could be related to the formatted transcriptions of the formatted spoken text.
Yes.
Is that how you interpret it, or are you giving me some different interpretation?
No, well, the interpretation is that a speech information request has to be speech in the two ways specified by the definition. It can't be just one of those ways. And believe me, if Apple had prior art that disclosed the second formatted text or embedded text example, they would have said, here it is. We wouldn't be here today if that were the case. So this is an important, this is not just a advisory opinion. There's harmful error here, because if the PTAP had gotten it right and said, yes, speech requires both, it would have then looked at Apple's petition and determined Apple doesn't allege that any of the prior art that it's citing meets that limitation. So game over. We would have been over at the institution phase.
Isn't the plain language, though, here, and tell me if I'm misreading this, isn't the plain language saying speech information request comprising, and it's using the word respectively, would be the formatted spoken text, and then it has something different that could correspond to this formatted transcriptions of the formatted spoken text. Do you see how I'm at least reading that?
Well, the definition applies. So speech information request means both of those elements, the spoken text and the embedded or formatted. So this language in the claim is not inconsistent with the definition. And you have to read the claim language in view of what the specification teaches. And the specification clearly teaches that speech, as used in Claim 15, requires both spoken text and the formatted text. So the claim language doesn't trump the definition. The definition clarifies and straightens out what that language means. So I don't think this renders the specification nugatory, or you would disregard the definition. You have to read this claim language in light of the definition, and the definition requires both clearly. There's no question about that at all. I hope I answered your question. Oh.
And I think I interrupted you.
You're deferring
Judge
back
Stoll,
to her.
So,
yeah, okay.
So let her finish her question.
Yes.
I didn't mean to interrupt her.
Yes, Judge
Stoll.
Oh,
no, I believe that I had the exact same question.
Okay, all right. Well, so this is not an advisory opinion, because if the PTAB had construed the claim properly, it would have had to determine that the petition doesn't allege prior art that discloses this critical element of or limitation of the claim. And so this is not We're not here for academics.
Did you argue this below?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Where
oh, yes.
Did you argue it?
In the preliminary response, Your Honor.
But you know that arguments that are made in the preliminary response, if not carried forward in the institution, are waived.
That is a statement that the PTAB says about, quote, patentability, close quote, not claim construction. And this court...
Claim construction doesn't stand on its own. It has to stand
well, it's relevant.
Otherwise, it is an advisory opinion.
It's irrelevant to patentability. But this court has been very clear in the area of claim construction, which is a question of law, that if it's been fully briefed by...
You do understand that we don't affirm claim construction. We don't reverse claim construction.
No.
We consider claim construction, and we might adopt a lower tribunal's claim construction so that we can decide whether to affirm or reverse patentability determinations, for example.
Yes.
So I disagree with you on that. I don't think that you could not just appeal a claim construction issue without having a patentability issue to go along with it. Otherwise, it becomes an advisory opinion.
Well, no,
so you run right into my question.
Well, that's true. The patentability issue is there, but...
But did you raise it during institution?
You'll note, Your Honor, that the PTAB, in its final decision, repeated and doubled down on its ruling that AVRS's construction and the lexicography it rejected. So if it was not an issue before the court and not relevant to the final decision, it wouldn't have been mentioned by the federal or the PTAB in that ruling. And this
your view is that even though the claim construction was raised pre-institution, because the board addressed it in its petition in response to a petition for rehearing, that shows that you preserved it.
Well, not so much it addressed it in the final decision as well. It doubled down, as I call it, on that issue. It repeated that, yes, we are disregarding the lexicography and we are holding that it's permissive or alternative and not mandatory. It said that because it saw the issue was live. It issued a full opinion on this point in the institution decision and then again doubled down on that. And this court was clear in Erickson versus TCL. It made it clear that when you have a legal issue like claim construction.
But what about did you make a patentability argument post institution about and relying on your more narrow interpretation of speech, that you're presenting to us today?
Well, we still made the point. We understood that the court had ruled, or the PTAB had ruled against us. And so this court does.
When did it rule against you?
In the institution decision.
Okay. And so where did you make it during? Can you give me a site?
I know that we talked about Cohen and the speech definition. It's mentioned in there, but this court, I want to be very clear, this court has not required in a patent infringement case, in a district court, the party that makes a claim construction argument and where the court has been appraised of it and ruled on it doesn't have to keep raising that issue to make it a preservation of error.
I'm not asking you that question.
Okay.
I want to make sure you understand my question. My question is whether you raised a patentability argument that relied on your construction of speech post-institution.
I do believe we did. There were two instances where we mentioned the speech construction issue. It was not argued extensively, obviously, because we had lost on that issue. And again, this court does not require you to engage in...
Do you have the record sites that we could look at?
I do on my computer. I don't have it right in front of me, Your Honor. But there is one or two passages in the response.
You're going to give them to us on rebuttal?
Okay, I'll do my best to find it right away for you. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I will do that. So, but is my 12 minutes up? Okay. All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes. No, I think that's fine, and we'll take it up in your rebuttal time.
Oh, thank you very much, Your Honor. Okay.
We're okay. Mr. Matsui.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Brian Matsui for Apple. The board's decision should be affirmed. First, I'd like to address why AVRS isn't entitled to relief on its claim construction argument, regardless of whether or not this court actually needs to address it. And then second, to the extent the court has any questions, I would be happy to address the procedural argument, which I understand my friend on the other side didn't actually get to.
Can you address the advisory opinion question that Judge Stoll previously raised to opposing counsel?
Certainly, Your Honor. I mean, this would be just a pure advisory opinion that AVRS is asking the court to provide. In its patent, the board, after institution, warned AVRS that it needed to present any arguments of patentability in its patent owner response at Appendix 360, or else they would be waived. And that's the identical language this court held in its Broadcom decision from 2 days ago, that where the court said that an issue was waived. And then AVRS failed to raise any arguments in its patent owner response. And the reason...
Did they challenge the claim construction and just do that? Or did they not make any argument as to patentability in light of their proffered claim construction?
They did challenge the claim construction. We're not arguing that they waived a claim construction argument, but as Judge Stoll, as you mentioned, you can't just have an abstract claim construction argument. This court, from district court cases or cases from the board, it won't address an abstract claim construction argument unless somebody shows that it actually goes to an issue that affects the judgment, such as patentability or in the district court patentability or infringement. But we know in this case that the board did not have any arguments going to patentability with respect to the claim construction issue that they're presenting now because the board expressly said so. If we look at Appendix 31 of the board's final written decision, there's a heading that says handling speech information requests. And the first line under that is for claimed speech information requests, petitioner asserts that a voicemail message at voicemail 50 server includes spoken text. And then when you go down to the bottom of that page, it says, patent owner makes no arguments specific to this aspect of the system transaction manager limitation, which is what this is talking about right here. And then if we go to Appendix 28, the board was very clear that it found at footnote 4, any arguments patent owner has not raised in its response are waived. And it cites this court's decision in Nuvasive. And the Nuvasive case is incredibly instructive here, because in that case, there was a public accessibility issue that was raised in the preliminary response, and then it was not at all raised in the patent owner response, and this court held that that was waived, that that was something that couldn't be addressed by the court. So that's on all fours with what we have here. On the precise issue of whether or not the prior art discloses the claim limitations here, there was no argument that was made that went to the claim construction at all. And in fact, they didn't present any argument in their opening brief either. All they did is they said there was a speech limitation. But they never pointed to what limitation this went to in the claim. So not only did they forfeit or waive the issue before the board, but they also did so before this court. Because it wasn't until the reply brief that they finally said, no, this is going to the term speech information request in the claims themselves. But that's too late. Just as a matter of appellate procedure, it can't be that an appellant can raise the issue in their reply brief after the issue has fully been presented in the opening brief and say, no, this is the argument that we're really trying to present. And again, if we look at the reply brief...
What about the argument that opposing counsel made about speech as a part of the speech information request limitation? What is your response to that in particular?
Well, I think that sort of just highlights the problem. Right now, at oral argument, AVRS is explaining how the speech term relates to the claims themselves. And that's just too late. Again, we have a board finding here that they made no argument with respect to speech information requests with respect to the prior art. And so it's just simply too late to do that. And the problem with doing it on appeal, not having done it before the board, is it deprives the petitioner the opportunity to actually respond to the arguments that might be made in the patent owner response. There was no ability for us to explain why these claims would be unpatentable, because they would, even under AVRS's construction.
Do you have an answer to the merits of this argument?
Certainly.
It's before us.
Certainly, Your Honor. I mean, I think that The important thing to look at is we're not fighting that there is a definition in the specification, but the question is what that definition means. The board at Appendix 17 was very clear that the specification has a definition of speech, that it's spoken text and spoken and embedded commands, but that's not the answer to the question. The question is, what does that definition mean? And the board said, when it looked at the intrinsic record, what that definition means is that speech encompasses spoken text and spoken and embedded commands. And when we look at Claim 15, as Judge Cunningham, you pointed out, it's very clear that speech information request doesn't have to include spoken and embedded commands. Because again, if we look at Claim 15, it says a system transaction manager, the system transaction manager utilizing a uniform system protocol for handling speech information requests and responses to speech information requests, the speech information requests and responses comprising respectively formatted spoken text and formatted transcriptions of the formatted spoken text. That right there.
Is that all that comprising language is superfluous if the claim, the phrase speech already includes that information?
It certainly would. And if we looked at Claim 1, for example, you will see at Claim 1 in Column 25 at around line 60, it says there's a uniform system protocol adapted to receive a speech information request, and it doesn't specify which of the three possibilities it is. And then in Claim 4, a dependent claim, it says, the system of Claim 1, wherein the speech information request comprises formatted spoken text. Claim 4 would be entirely superfluous if you accepted AVRS's construction, because it would always have to have all three of spoken text and spoken and embedded commands. And there just would be no reason at all to have that claim, to have that claim language. In addition, just to briefly note on columns 9 and 10 and
let's talk about the merits. What difference does it make if they did or don't need claim 4? We really want to be sure that we understand the substantive issues that are properly before us on appeal.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
I wanted to encourage you to discuss the substance of the issues that are before us, not whether they did or didn't need Claim 4.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think that I was just using that as an illustration. But on Claims 15 and Claim 17, I think that on the claim construction issue, if that's what we're talking about here, it's very clear from those claim terms that if you assume that speech information request is what they're talking about, it doesn't have to include spoken text and spoken and embedded commands. I think that if we look at claims 15 and the next element, it's talking about at around line 25, the first user application service adapter configured to generate speech information requests from spoken text produced by at least one of the users. And so again, that's just reinforcing the fact that speech information requests, the speech, doesn't require all three of spoken text and spoken and embedded commands, because again, that would be superfluous about that. And again, Claim 17 has basically the same type of language.
Do you agree that while there is that section in the beginning of the patent that defines speech, there are later sections in the patent that have more language like may include, typically includes, that suggests that that definition is that speech may include those three elements, but it doesn't have to have all of them? I mean, how does that, I think you described it as a interpretation of the interpretation or interpretation of the lexicography and what those words mean. Is it that situation, or is this a situation where there is no lexicography because the rest of the specification undermines that definition?
I mean, I think that to the extent there is a clear lexicography here, it's the lexicography that the board adopted. That what you're talking about is that speech basically means that it's spoken text and spoken in embedded commands. It encompasses that, but doesn't require all of them. I think if you think of a word like produced, colon, fruits and vegetables, that right there is defining what produce is, but it doesn't mean that you have to have fruits and vegetables in order to have produce. Fruits are produce and vegetables are produce. And so it's the same type of thing. And so to your point, Judge Stoll, yes, there is plenty of language in the specification, such as in column 17 at line 40, where it says speech information requests, which includes formatted spoken text and perhaps formatted spoken and embedded commands. It's showing that it doesn't have to include all three. What you won't find anywhere in the specification is any indication that there is a requirement that you have all three of spoken text and spoken and embedded commands. That's just nowhere to be found anywhere in the patent itself, making the all three of these mandatory. If the court has no questions about the procedural issue, we would ask the court to affirm.
Any more questions? Thank you, Mr. Matsui.
Thank you.
Mr. Buettner?
Yes, I was able to find that, fortunately, thanks to the iPhone, in paper 20, which is the patent owner's response, at page 17, the patent owner argued that Cohen...
What appendix page are you on?
I don't have the appendix number, just the paper number. Sorry, it's in the patent owner's response at page 17. I don't have that appendix number handy. I apologize, Your Honor. It says, nor does Cohen contemplate the creation of speech information requests, which, of course, we had previously argued unsuccessfully that speech means all three. And by the way, the counsel for Apple is just simply wrong. The definition of speech in the lexicography says it means spoken text and spoken and embedded commands.
What is your response to his analogy to produce and vegetables and fruit?
Well, it's rotten vegetables, because this is the clear language. When he said that there is no language in the specification that mandates all three, I would just point to the actual lexicography that we rely on, which says all three, and. It doesn't say or may or include or tends to be.
What about all the other passages that Judge Stoll walked you through where it said, like, perhaps or
and
typically or may?
Yes, they're not irreconcilably inconsistent with this. They talk about it may include. It doesn't say mandatory, I agree, but there are seven passages that say and all the way through. It says the present invention involves or includes the speech as mandatorily specified in the lexicography. So when the patent says the present invention, this court generally gives that some pretty important weight in the claim construction analysis. So you first start out with the lexicography, which is clear. Nobody questions it. It is clear, unambiguous, and it specifies all three. So that's an important distinction between what counsel has told you. That's just not true. Secondly, Broadcom and Nuvasiv are distinguishable easily because there the appellant never even made the argument in the court below. They didn't even raise the issue here. It was raised, fully briefed, fully decided by the PTAB, and therefore this court has the full benefit of the PTAB's analysis of the issue. And as to claim 4, their spin on claim 15, no one addressed claim 15 based upon the clear lexicography. So when they try to say that it doesn't matter whether you apply the lexicography or not, well, we don't know, because that was never addressed, because the PTAB, ruled very early on in the institution decision that the lexicography didn't apply. So that is just speculation on Apple's part. And furthermore, the argument that we didn't raise this issue about harm until the reply brief is again wrong. If you look at page 18 of our opening brief, in bold letters we say, because Apple did not contend or submit any evidence showing that the asserted prior art disclosed the speech limitation in the claims in dispute, the court should reverse the PTAB's judgment. So we said in our very opening brief.
How do you respond to Apple's argument that the comprising clause would be superfluous if we accept your interpretation here of speech?
You know, it could be. And I guess my answer is so what when the patent clearly says this is what this term means, that definition, that lexicography should be applied. And if it does render some claim language superfluous, it doesn't render it superfluous as if it cuts it out. So it isn't rendering it nugatory. It's just saying, yeah, that is redundant of the, lexicography, but that, so what? I mean, the lexicography trumps and should govern, and it's not inconsistent with it. If it was inconsistent, that would be a problem.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
I found your site. It's JA413 is the page. But I'm having a little bit of a trouble because that page doesn't relate to the grounds on which the PTAB found the claims unpatentable, and I don't see where it makes an argument based on the definition of speech.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I go back to the fundamental point that when you're dealing with a claim construction issue, when it's been fully briefed and fully decided by the lower court, you are not required to repeat that argument every time it could appear down the road. In a patent infringement case, we don't ask parties to repeat their claim.
There's a specific rule in the PTAB that says if you're going to make a patentability argument pre-institution, if you don't make it post-institution, you've waived it.
But that's in cases where there's not a question of law that's already been firmly decided. And again, if it was a dead issue or if the PTAB thought that didn't apply anymore, it wouldn't have, again, doubled down.
I understand you've got a claim construction argument. Nobody is saying that you waived your claim construction argument.
Oh, okay.
The only argument or assertion, and it was found by the board, is that you didn't make a patentability argument based on that claim construction during institution.
And that statement by Apple is wrong. It is incorrect.
Finding by the board is incorrect.
They never found that, I'm sorry, what finding by the board? They tried to argue that the board found that we didn't make any argument based upon speech. That's not true. The handling issue is, it said, as to this specific issue, it clearly said that this specific issue, AVRS, the patent owner, did not make a patentability argument. That was as to that specific issue, handling of speech information requests. And so the PTAB was very clear when it said that. It was talking about this specific issue. So,
it says, patent owner makes no arguments specific to this aspect of the system transaction manager.
Yes.
And it's handling speech information.
But it was about the handling aspect of it, not the speech aspect of it. So we didn't make an argument about handling. We made an argument about speech, and that was separate. So that citation by Apple is incorrect in my view, with all due respect to learned counsel. I think I've exceeded my time by a good bit, so I will, unless the court has anything else, but okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission.